little bit later on, a Tuesday trifecta. Damon Ratto and Kolsky here. Ray and Matt, hello to the both of you. Good to have you aboard once again. What's shaking?
We have a good lineup today, so that's shaking.
Yeah, we definitely do. Definitely do.
That's somehow that's one of the strangest first things Ray has ever said. But he's right.
Yeah, I think we should keep Glanville on for as long as possible.
I did not expect Ray to come out of the gate boosting our guest list. That's just not what I was expecting. It's sort of it took me off guard.
If it helps, you suck. But the guest list is very good.
That does make me feel better. It feels more like a normal show.
Hey, okay, see, I didn't want you to be disoriented this early in.
What credit to Lucas and Nash, who've put together a really good one today, and it is a good one today. And look, we got a lot of stuff to get into, a lot of little funny things and cute things to get into today. A lot of, hey, I'm very interested in Bill Belichick and Cam Newton and what that would look like. And for a coach who is looking for a new toy with a brand new style, boy, Cam Newton represents a new line of football thought for Bill Belichick that he hasn't really had a chance to explore very much. So there's a lot of interesting in there, and we're going to get into all of that today. But we do have to start with Ian Desmond. Ian Desmond last night released an Instagram post that was really something else. He will not be playing baseball this summer. And he put some things on the table that you rarely hear from players, even in this moment of sharing thoughts about racism and systemic things that are working against black people throughout sports, throughout life. It was almost as if over a series of Instagram posts, we watched Ian Desmond connect the dots in his mind of what he was thinking of in real time, what news was springing to life in terms of memories being jogged, the phrase white power being echoed at a minor league, or not a minor league, a little league baseball game when he was just playing little league baseball in Sarasota. He talked about the systemic, basically boxing out of black people that baseball has chosen to do with its expensive youth travel teams and how much things have changed since he was a kid. And it was a cathartic post. It was really something else. And he had an awful lot to say and share, and we'll be going through it and peeling it back like an onion today. But it was among the most powerful things I've read from any athlete as we have entered this time of powerful statements from athletes.
The thing that struck me about it most, I mean, other than the content, was the fact that everything you're ever told about social media is don't go in there saying anything you haven't really thought of. And what he did was basically do a series of stream of consciousness items in which you could see him thinking as it was growing. And the more he did, the better it got and the more meaningful it got. And the more understandable it got. It was everything you shouldn't do on social media, except that it was perfect because it's clear that he had thought about all this stuff for a long time and had sort of bit his lip. He said, yeah, I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say it. No, now I'm going to say it. And now I'm going to say all of it. And that was the most fascinating thing to me, because he really did violate all the things that people tell you about social media. And just spoke from his heart. And, you know, all the credit to him for being able not only to reach that place inside him, but to perform it in such a way that it made it better.
Yeah, I to add on to Ray's point, this really did feel like a career, if not a lifetime's worth of previously held back thoughts. Like, this was stuff that has been in his head his whole life. I mean, it was, you know, I think it was 9 pages or something of sort of type on Instagram, and it speaks to sort of the general view of his experiences as a biracial kid and man in America. And there's so much here. It's so thoughtful and eloquent and I think incredibly impactful. And with any luck, that's the sort of thing that someone who maybe is not as open-minded as we might like and as we might be used to in the Bay Area, who likes Ian Desmond without really thinking about it too deeply, might read that and actually open their mind a little bit. That's how it strikes me, as something that really could be affecting.
It was raw. I mean, I think that that's what we appreciate in a world where we were judging how carefully edited so many teams' statements were about Black Lives Matters, and you could feel people measuring their sentence by the word, making sure it lands right, offending no one on any side of any argument. And Ian Desmond was just like, I got memories. I got feelings. This is catharsis. It was as if he were laying on the psychiatrist's couch, just sort of unloading memories as they were coming back to him in real time. It is a powerful piece, and we suggest if you haven't checked it out, you should check it out. He unloads on Major League Baseball, saying that it's failing minorities, but he's not just leaving it as Major League Baseball is failing minorities at the major league level. He immediately pivots to kids and to children and to opportunities lost now due to travel teams having an expenditure which basically, you know, expels black kids from consideration based on the price point of entry. And, you know, what's really, really, I think, powerful is you can feel him examine his own privilege, not the privilege that comes with being half white, but the privilege that comes with cashing 100% of a major league paycheck since 2009. This guy's been in baseball since 2009. Even if he didn't make a lot of money, he still made an awful lot of money, you know, and that has put him in a different bracket. It's put him in a different neighborhood than he would have been in. And he kind of, it all hits him as he says he examines his privilege afforded to his family. And he sees that baseball has totally separated his kids from the reality of other kids. And it's not just sports opportunity, it's educational opportunity. He talks about a young man who he mentored who ended up being killed. I mean, it's really, really powerful. And I've got a little selected to read from it. I'm sure, Ray, Matt, you found a part that you think is an outstanding part. We're going to come on back and share some of this with you and get into more of it with you on the other side of this. We are just getting underway this afternoon, and it is really good to be here once again. And we got fun stuff to talk about today, but we got real things happening and a real discussion from a guy who, I got to tell you, Ian Desmond, all right, he was a National, then he was, I can't remember, now he's a Rocky. Like, Ian Desmond has always been one of those, hey, he's a good player, but he's never stood out in a crowd to me. He has never come forward as someone who I thought would be at the center of, wow, what a statement by an active major league player who is not going to go play Major League Baseball for a myriad of reasons this upcoming season. We're going to come on back with all of that. You're invited to join the conversation today. 888-957-9570. If you have read the Desmond Instagram posts, we would love to hear what you think of them. We are just getting underway, and our countdown's officially on to start naming the 10 greatest Bay Area athletes. We're going to do that looking for you to submit your top 10 list at 957thegame.com. And starting on Monday, July 13th, we will be taking a fan vote, and we will get our top 10, a little groupthink. We will figure it all out. Should be an awful lot of fun. Get your submissions ready. The debate starts Monday. Here on 95.7 The Game, Damon Ratto and Kolsky, we are just underway. Doug Glanville later on, Howard Beck, a Tuesday trifecta. We look forward to talking to you here on 95.7 The Game.
Damon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
On this afternoon, we're going to say hello to Doug Glanville, who is a longtime major leaguer, now a baseball analyst on ESPN, who yesterday penned an incredibly powerful article about social justice, his experiences as a major leaguer, as a guy who has had a lot of different descriptions of him following his own name. And it's all about the comma effect and what comes after the comma. and how when you're a black man dressed in a major league uniform, there's a lot of compliments that come after the comma. When you're not wearing a major league uniform, it's amazing how different what comes after the comma really is. It's a powerful piece, as is what Ian Desmond shared on Instagram last night, and that's what Ray, Matt, and I are talking about right here on 95.7 The Game. Guys, there are there is an awful lot in 9 pages of Instagram posts, I believe, from Ian Desmond, but here is what I thought was the most powerful portion of the entire catharsis that he was having last night, where he really was criticizing baseball for reflecting all that is so wrong with everything else that's going on in the world right now. He says, and I quote, "America's pastime is failing to do what it could, just like the country it entertains. We have a labor war, rampant individualism on the field. In clubhouses, we have racist, sexist, homophobic jokes or flat-out problems. We've got cheating. We've got minority issues from the top down. One African-American GM, 2 African-American managers, less than 8% black players, and no black majority team owner. Perhaps most disheartening of all, a puzzling lack of focus onto how to change those numbers. If baseball is America's pastime, maybe it's never more fitting than right now." I mean, there's some serious analysis going on in terms of sports being the microcosm of it all right there. And you could feel him being like almost pinioned underneath him connecting all the dots. It really is a powerful piece.
And
unfortunately, Ray's internet is not powerful again today.
I want to relate something to that quickly earlier in the piece where, and this is a simple thought, this one he has, but I think it can be tied directly to what he says at the end of what you just read. Which, here we go. "Why isn't society's number one priority giving all kids the best education possible? If we seriously want to see change, isn't education where it all starts? Give all kids a safe place to go for 8 hours a day, where their teachers or coaches are happy to see them, where they feel supported and loved." And he sort of goes on to tie that back into baseball, as you read. And I do think so much about the world that we've gone through over the last 3 to 5 months, that so many of the problems we are dealing with, outside of obviously a deadly disease, but so many of these problems come simply down to a lack of basic common sense and human decency. And you know, educating kids is a good place to start, where it seems like we'd all be able to agree, just like you'd think we'd all be able to agree to listen to doctors during a pandemic, you know. And in my mind, a lot of what has gone wrong with America comes down to people willfully refusing to listen to common sense and be basically decent.
It's more insidious than that, though. Because everything you say is true, but it also speaks to something that is particularly American about the notion that we should be profiting off the labor of our children. And by that, I mean pay to play in baseball, pay to play in soccer, pay to play in all youth sports. One of the big reasons why baseball is dying in the inner city is because it's become an expensive pastime for children. It used to be a thing where you could go to your neighborhood park, wherever it was, and there would be somebody there who could organize a ball team against the next park or the park after that, and you would have basically a park league. And it didn't cost anything. You know, maybe it was $5 for a T-shirt, but that's it. That's turned into sort of these mega little leagues in which you have travel teams, and then you have Uber travel teams, and it costs a bunch just to get your kid on any of these teams. And it becomes a more insular process wherein, hey, my kid wants to play baseball. Where do I find out where to go? He says, well, my friend so-and-so could get you on a team, but you sort of have to know that guy. So it's become a closed club. And it's one of the reasons why there are 8% players in baseball now. And it's because baseball doesn't, Major League Baseball wants to do the cheapest thing the cheapest way, which is why they've stopped scouting in the inner cities and they've gone to the Caribbean, and they've gone to Latin America because it's cheaper to do that. And the fact that money drives so much of this makes it not just a problem that speaks to the racism of the relative few, but the general greed of the many. It's, oh, you don't have money for your kid to play? Well, I don't know. Give him a basketball. Find him something else to do. We're not going to help you out here. And there are people in Little League, don't get me wrong, who have tried to address this, but not nearly enough. And over the generations, you have seen baseball interest decline in the inner city because kids don't see role models. They don't see the Ian Desmonds very much. And they didn't see many Doug Glanvilles when he was playing. It's a systemic problem that it's now eating its own tail.
Fair question being asked on the text line by a listener who says, when it comes to baseball, who is in charge to determine the perfect ratio for minority coaches to players? The owners is the question. And here's the thing. I don't know what the perfect ratio is. I don't know whose job it is to necessarily solve this. But being left to the charge of the owners, we are in a situation that is so deplorable that, yeah, the owners clearly are in charge, and this is not something that they've gone about addressing in any way that is real. I mean, let's be totally honest. When Ian Desmond brings up the fact that there are two African-American managers in Major League Baseball, let's examine who they are. You have half Japanese Dave Roberts. So, I'm not saying he ain't all the way black or anything like that, but we have one of our African-American candidates is a mixed race candidate. And the only reason the other one is in the room is because the Astros got caught cheating and they asked Dusty to come on in and mop up the mess. That's it.
And don't you think it's notable?
Roberts. Yeah, it's Dave Roberts and Dusty Baker. That is your black manager in baseball list.
And isn't it notable that Dusty, the guy who they went to when they needed some help to clean things up and they really needed a professional to come in, he didn't have a job.
Exactly. And look, maybe he didn't necessarily want one through that time.
Sure.
Dusty might have reached that I'm going to kick my feet up stage of his career and just was too tempted to not to. But had it not been Dusty Baker, the chances of option B being black are just so working against the math that is represented by reality. It's safe to say that if Dusty had said no, there'd be a white guy or certainly not a black guy in the Astros dugout right now managing it.
And I think we see with regularity in all sports, NBA included, when coaches of color have medium success or are relatively mediocre, they rarely, if ever, get a second chance. When white coaches are mediocre, they almost always get a second chance. And those are the sorts of things that I think a lot of people don't think about that. I mean, that is systemic racism in action. Whether people are doing it deliberately or not, there's something about the thought process of those in power that leads to those circumstances.
Well, more to the point, look one step up. How many general managers of color are there?
Two.
Yeah, I mean,
excuse
how
me,
many?
No, in, one.
Yeah, one in baseball, I think. I think it's two in basketball, but I'm not sure. But the fact is that we've never really addressed the problem of going out to find qualified minority executives, because that's where the hiring gets done. And, you know, there, I want to say it was a decade ago, there were like 8 black coaches in the NBA. It has never gone beyond that and has dropped as low as 4. Now, either all those guys failed or they were replaced by somebody else. And as far as I know, other than Masai Ujiri and until recently,
there are 8 black general managers in the NBA, if that's what we're talking about.
Okay, and
I have the list for you here.
I trust you, but go ahead.
Well, this is from a April article right after the Bulls hired Mark Eversley, who became the Bulls' first black general manager.
Goodbye, Garpax.
Yeah,
can we celebrate that for a moment? By the way, yay!
Sure.
Continue with the list, please.
Let's see. I don't have the full list. This is spread out a little more than I expected. Give me 1 second to sum it up. Here are some names, though. Del Demps. Masai, you mentioned. Talk amongst yourselves. I'm going to find the complete list.
I'm not sure Del Demps wasn't fired.
Yeah, you might be right, because this is not. There's. Hold on. Talk amongst yourselves.
Well, either way. Whatever the number is, however many names you come up with, in direct relationship to a black man standing in the sport of basketball, it is most insulting, I believe, in that sport to not see the advancement. If black front office executive and decision-making advancement isn't the charge of the NBA, what sport will take that charge, right? I mean, it really is something else. And when you talk about, you know, an opportunity given to a black man, got to be knocked out of the park in a way that a white guy probably doesn't have to knock it all the way out of the park. There is an awful lot of truth to that. There is. Let me, you know, look, this is, you know, I don't even know how much our audience wants to hear this. And I don't even care, because it's what I want to talk about today. And it's what you guys, I think, want to talk about, too. So, you know, if you haven't done some personal inventory in the last month or so, you're an incomplete human being. I don't care how perfect you think you are in terms of race relations. If you have not done some personal inventory, shame on you, and you're part of the problem. And your refusal to think about things that everyone is talking about is another reason why America is only allowed to walk as its slowest pedestrian. I am very pleased to report to you, as you might imagine, neither I nor my wife, Jillian, are card-carrying, clearly overt racists. We're pretty good at that. Where can we improve? What is a level of privilege that we need to examine ourselves? And look, I came up in radio, did it the hard way. I don't know what color had to do with anything. This is an unfair medium. The amount of people who succeed, fail, I don't even know. Here's what I came up with. There was never a time in my life where I was talking into this microphone in front of me, looking to represent anybody but myself. Not for a millisecond, not for a moment, was there any expectation of people thinking, well, you know, Damon, what a tribute to his race he really is. I tell you, that Damon Bruce, the way that he talks, boy, does he hold up a standard for Caucasian people that other Caucasians would really want to measure up to. Never once in my life have I thought that. And that is something that a black person has to think about every single day of their career. You know, I can't have an off day. I have to be excellent every day. I am representing myself, opportunities for future people in front of me, behind me. It's overwhelming, the pressure to succeed. It goes far beyond the individual. I never think that way. There is an element of privilege in my life that I thought about. My wife and I were talking about it. Here's one thing I never do. Paddle hard for anyone but myself, thinking that everyone in the canoe needs me to paddle as hard as I possibly can. I don't think like that.
And that is an element of privilege that I have examined in my life. I don't know if I've overshared or not, but there you go. I hope I killed enough time for you to look up the number of GMs, Matt.
You absolutely did, and here is the list. Spurs GM Brian Wright, James Jones is the GM in Phoenix, Kobe Altman in Cleveland, Trajan Langdon is the guy who took over for Dell Demps with the New Orleans Pelicans. Scott Perry still technically the Knicks GM, although that may change. Elton Brand with the Sixers. Calvin Booth is the Nuggets GM. Now, the trick is, some of those GMs have more power than others based on who is the president of basketball operations and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, like Masai, for instance, I don't think is technically the GM anymore. That's why I did not mention his name on that list, which the eighth is Mark Eversley, who the Bulls just hired. But the Bulls also hired Arturis Karnisovas, who's the new executive vice president of basketball operations. So, you know, Eversley is technically probably the second in command when it comes to player personnel. That is different throughout every organization, but here's the thing. 8 out of 30, given the demographic makeup of the league, is very low. I mean, it's just an extremely low number. It really is. So it might be a lot better than the NFL or Major League Baseball, but it's not enough.
Well, the more compelling number is that none of those general managers that you listed are on their second job. It's still their first one.
Yep.
And the test of determining how successful black executives can be in any sport, and the NBA is probably the most gratifying example of this, is do you get hired again? You know, I mean, because sometimes you very often get hired to fix a bad team. And if the team doesn't get fixed right away, you get fired. And then after that, it's a scramble to see if you get another job. Now, you know, Kobe Altman's been there for a while, but it's pretty clear that he does not have a whole lot of power.
He hasn't been in the GM position that long.
Well, he's been in there since 17, but moves were made over his head by Dan Gilbert, the owner.
Right.
So what we're talking about here is general managers who have the freedom of movement that, say, Bob Myers does in Golden State.
Yeah, I think Elton Brand is the guy on that list who probably has that. I don't know, Trajan Langdon. Scott Perry certainly has had that, although I'm not sure that's to anyone's benefit. And yeah, I think he has it anymore with Leon Rose there. That's right.
By the way, that's not to anyone's benefit is one of the nicest acts of shade you've ever thrown.
I mean, it's been a rough ride for Scott Perry. We can all admit that, I think. I do think James Jones has control in Phoenix. So, you know, again, it varies. I think in the Spurs GM, Brian Wright, he's only had that title, I don't think, for even a year. And he's, you know, obviously going to have to work in tandem with other people in that organization. He's not going to be able to do anything unilaterally by himself. So, but that, to be fair, that varies for white GMs as well. The problem here is that it's, you know, a little over a quarter of the league in a league that is, what, 80% black? 85% black? I don't have the number in front of me.
How many bites at the apple do you get?
82.
How many bites at the apple?
82% people of color. Yeah. Sorry,
go
ahead.
How many bites at the apple do you get? And most white guys in the world get multiple bites at the apple. Black guys rarely even get the apple, much less multiple bites at it. And that is what the last few weeks of examining systemic racism and where it comes from and how it's gotten here and what we're doing about it has been an important moment in time. And again, I think that we live in an enlightened part of the country. And in this enlightened part of the country, I think that there's more of an opportunity for self-examination and realization than there are in less enlightened parts of the country. Now, they need to really start catching up. We need to do a better job. And then when you start looking around sports, at what point are you guys going to become part of the solution?
You know, I mean, that's if a black man in America can't get more of a fair shake in sports, that just shows you that the entire field is tilted against them right there. And that alone, famous Chris Rock sketch. Chris Rock was talking about his multi-million dollar mansion in New Jersey, right? And he's like, I live in a neighborhood that's got about 100 homes in it, multi-million dollar homes up and down. And of 100 homes, there are 4 black residents. They are me, Eddie Murphy, Jay-Z, Mary J. Blige. He's like, I'm not going to brag about myself, but you bought a ticket to my show tonight, so you think I'm good. I'm going to tell you, Eddie Murphy's about as brilliant a comedian that's ever lived. Mary J. Blige is one of the great singers, and Jay-Z might be one of the 5 greatest rappers of all freaking time. He's like, you know who my neighbor is? A dentist. Not the greatest dentist in the world. Not one of the 5 greatest dentists in the world. He's a dentist. And there's a lot there. If you have to have someone interpret that sketch for you, Chris Rock delivers it a lot better than I do. But there's an awful lot there. I mean, there's an awful lot there to be examined. Ian Desmond's Instagram post left an awful lot to be examined, an awful lot of questions that these leagues need to start asking themselves. The NBA says that when it does have a season, hopefully a season in Orlando to show us in a few weeks or so here, that the courts and the jerseys will have different sayings and names, and Black Lives Matter will be on the court. And I've seen some people already lining up to criticize that, which is just why? I mean, why are you going to fight this fight? What good could this fight get you to not be supportive of it? I mean, I don't understand it. What's really odd is one of the most vehemently against it guys is I don't know why I read Jason Whitlock today. I did, but Jason Whitlock is not the ally I think the black community is looking for. I got to be honest with you. It is an unbelievable turn that I read from him. And look at it this way. One of the most respected journalists I know thinks that, you know, he's got an awful lot to improve upon. But it's really amazing where we are in this moment in time. And with all the racial tension, with all the problems, with all the COVID-19, should sports be even happening? I mean, that is a legitimate question, and that's what Ian Desmond basically his starting point was here. It's like the world is burning. Maybe we should put it out before we start playing freaking games again. But, oh, look at this game that we're trying to play and how flawed and damaged it is. And it echoes all the problems that we're seeing in society right now. It's really something else. We'll have more on that, more from Doug Glanville, who wrote a really, really good piece. That's up on ESPN.com. Howard Beck is going to join us today, a Tuesday trifecta a little bit later on, and we are rolling here on 95.7 The Game. 888-957-9570 is the number. We are brought to you by Fremont Bank, full-service banking, no compromises.
Demon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We hope to talk to Doug Glanville in about a half an hour from right now. Longtime major leaguer. He's now with ESPN. Wrote a very powerful piece about social justice that's on The Undefeated right now. I suggest you take a look at it. It is really, really well done, as was an Instagram post from The Gut last night from Ian Desmond as he was explaining why he wasn't going to go participate in an upcoming major league season, and it wasn't COVID-19 concerns as much as it was just concerns for the world that he's looking at right now and where baseball really is in attempting to find solutions. And it was pointed, and it's really, really something else. You know, he said that baseball is failing minorities, especially children. He criticized travel ball youth culture, and it basically expels kids based on its cost. And when he was a kid, the sport was affordable to play, even at its highest levels for children. He had a flashback to his Little League days in Sarasota where his team would break huddle by saying white power. He was one of just 2 black kids on the team. And again, he was biracial. And they just had to go along with it. I mean, it was just something that the team like
That was their battle cry? It's just, wow. Okay.
That's hard to understand, right? I mean, I would love more context for that. But this another thing that jumped out to me here, although it was a very small piece of it, was the sort of throwing the clubhouse culture under the bus. And I'm not in a bad way. I don't mean to say he shouldn't have. But I think
we got
a lot
to work on our own.
And I think we're all aware our sports clubhouses, locker rooms, etc., are bastions for certainly sexist and homophobic jokes. And he's saying racist as well, and I certainly believe him. I think that probably depends on the sport. But that's something that I think the sports world has accepted for far too long that needs to change. It's all part of a culture that supports systemic racism and sexism. That's the issue.
It's one of the many things that sports accepts in pursuit of the mythical notion of team building. The mythology around sports is so pernicious in so many ways that addressing that means going into every locker room and saying, different world, guys. If you can't change with that world, you can't be here. And the fact is, sports teams don't operate that way. They tolerate as much as they need to based on your talent. And if you want to be reprehensible, they will let you be reprehensible. And if you want to be an agent for change and societal good, that's going to depend on your batting average. It's going to depend on your points per game. It's always been that way. It's been a weird meritocracy, and merit has not been defined by, are you inclusive? Do you embrace everybody? Or do you think you're part of a special weird He-Man women's haters club where you get to decide what teammates you accept and which ones you don't? And what Ian Desmond was saying is that not enough people are speaking up on that, because it is a baseline dynamic of sports in America, because it's a baseline dynamic of America.
I was watching a Netflix special. I think the name of it was called The Followers, and it's really, really heavy. It's about how in Baltimore there was this priest who systemically hid behind the Baltimore Police Department, and this priest used his all-girls high school to sexually molest a generation of Catholic girls in Baltimore. It is stunning. It's bad. One of the things that it really points out was that one of the first women that came forward had a memory that was triggered that she didn't necessarily even think would be triggered or anything. Like, she wasn't thinking about it. Something happened, and all of a sudden, a floodgate of memories came back to her. And I'm wondering if Ian Desmond didn't have a floodgate of memories open up, you know, when he's there talking about, you know, I totally forgot about it. But then I remembered that we used to break our huddle as a Little League team saying white power. The president of the United States tweeted out a video with someone who is clearly a supporter of his screaming white power. Like, I'm wondering if that didn't trigger this. I'm wondering if that isn't what made him go, oh, my God, everything I'm looking at is just so wrong. I'm not going to go play baseball. I'm not going to entertain anybody when I have something more to say. And this is a moment in time where players are finding their voice, their consciousness, and I think that there is a crowd that wants it, wants to receive it. You know, 10 years ago, I was Mr. Sports Talk Radio should be sports talk and keep all your politics out of it and just it. Let's talk sports. Let's get away from everything. You can't anymore. You can't anymore. And if you try to, you are just part of the complicit problem that never addresses what needs to be addressed. And here's the deal. Black people have been talking about it for so long. Just them talking about it obviously hasn't done enough. Until white people, until people in a position of power can really do something about it,
unless that's being acknowledged, nothing's going to happen. There will be no change. You know, what could happen? What is one stroke? What is one magic lever any league could pull to instantly make things better? It doesn't exist. Inch by inch. That's how you travel down this road. Inch by inch.
Yeah, that is... That's certainly true. I mean, there's no question. There's no master stroke that cures racism, right? But just to go back to the middle of your point, the sports world is not, it's not just at this point, I would say, you know, complicit in the way that anyone who's not overtly anti-racist is complicit. The sports world, particularly the American sports world, particularly today's American sports world, that values the NFL most and the NBA probably second most, at least in terms of cultural relevance. Those two sports are dominated by black men. The vast majority of the guys who entertain us in our favorite sports are black men. And if we feel comfortable having them on our television entertaining us with physical achievement, but not comfortable saying their lives matter, that's worse than complicit. That's actively taking advantage of the marginalization of an entire group of people.
That's shut up and dribble. Come to life.
Right.
It's more than shut up and dribble, though. It's a weird, and I know players who have brought this word up in the past have been pilloried for it. It's a weird kind of slavery, only you get paid really well. We want you to perform for us. We want you to entertain us, but we don't want you to talk to us, and we certainly don't want you to make us think. And the fact is, we are at a stage in our national development where we are losing the opportunity to listen because people who have been trying to get people to listen are about at the stage of giving up and going, okay, fine, we'll do it our way. And it's the refusal to listen that, frankly, has put us in the place we are today racially. And it's why what Ian Desmond said and what Doug Glanville said is almost like a Hail Mary for people who want to listen. It's, here's the message. Here's the message we've been trying to give you forever. Will you listen now? And I don't know if we don't get it this time that there will be any more people bothering. They'll just say, okay, you don't care. Fine. We're going to make the changes our way. And maybe one of those changes is fewer people who want to play sports decide, nah, there's no avenue for us there. And you know, I mean, how many ways do you want to be told that there's something wrong with where we all live? We've been ignoring it for way too long. We've been denying it for way too long. And the idea that somehow there is a way to turn the clock back is absurd. We have already crossed that line. There's no looking back to, quote, the good old days, because it might turn out that us finally listening to others instead of shouting might be the good old days, and they're happening now, and we should seize them while we can.
Text line says, you know, you guys are so full of it. If sports were happening right now, you'd be talking about sports. And that's the point Ian Desmond, I think, is making. Let's seize upon this moment to focus on what's real and what matters. Who went 3-for-4 in this baseball game today does not really matter. And if we go ahead and just focus right back on sports, will we be losing a valuable piece of the conversation? Look at what the hell sports just did that couldn't happen in the state of Mississippi forever. Okay? The state of Mississippi loved the Confederate patch on its flag, and it wasn't changing it for nothing forever. Now, I'm not saying it is the running back at Mississippi State who said, I ain't carrying a ball again unless that flag comes down. It was the SEC.
it was the NCAA saying, you don't get tournaments. You don't get money. We're not going to pay you for overt racism anymore. You don't get to cash in over here if you're making people uncomfortable over there. And that is what got people's attention. Snatching people by their purse strings is sometimes the only way to get people's attention. And we're watching a moment of evolution. And it's something else. It's powerful. It's more important than the Chiefs won the Super Bowl. Who gives a crap? 888-957-9570. Welcome to your 3 o'clock hour.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco, a radio.com sports station.
The NBA is going to have Black Lives Matter on the courts when they get back to playing or get to playing in Disney. That is the plan anyways, and whether or not they play in Disney, we'll worry about that as we get closer to it. There's a lot of signs today pointing to we are watching COVID-19 get closer and closer to the NBA's chosen prince in waiting. If LeBron is indeed the king, Zion is the prince, and three players on the New Orleans Pelicans, not three members of the Pelicans, not some trainer on the Pelicans, but three players have tested positive for COVID-19. That is a direct threat to His Majesty. Players are self-isolating. They hope to reset and test negative in a couple of days, because we know that these tests are not 100% positive at all times, or accurate, I should say, not just positive. But, you know, the Nets are starting to kind of fall apart. DeAndre Jordan tested positive. He's not going to Orlando. Dinwiddie yesterday tested positive. He's yet to declare himself out of the bubble. The Denver Nuggets have three players who are testing positive. Their facility got shut down today. Nikola Jokic, he tested positive over in Serbia. Look, I don't know where the truth or the safer environment lies. I mean, these guys, how about this? No one's in a bubble, and people are getting COVID-19 left and right. Will they be actually safer in Disney? I don't know if we can. How about this? I know we can't answer that until we actually go and do it. But with the way the guys are coming up positive, I don't know if it is the worst idea in the world. I'm not saying it's the best idea in the world. I'm saying it's an actual science experiment that we are going to run with actual humans with no test group. Everybody's in the test group, and let's find out. There's no placebo. Everybody go, risk it, and we'll find out how it goes. Good luck, everybody.
I do think, just basically, when you look at the plan, it's hard to imagine how it would be less safe than just living your life in a normal place. You know, obviously you can be super safe in your hometown, right? If you stay in your house and never ever leave. But
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.